Hello and welcome to this special teaser episode of The Storyteller Naked Villainy. We are nearly there, and I know you'll be on edge waiting for the next episode. And if you can't cope with the wait, then you could ease the pain by delving even deeper into the facts and hear in-depth interviews with key people in the case. At the time of this recording, I've made 44 bonus episodes. Some are analysis of the evidence, and the rest are interviews. There are also documents, production lists, photos, key locations, and much more. I'm going to let you hear some snippets from the bonus episodes to give you a taster of the extra content, starting with pathologist Professor James Grieve, who was not only involved in the reinvestigation, but he knew Brenda. His interview is so in-depth, it's spread over two episodes, and he reveals quite a lot that we didn't hear in court, including an explanation regarding the size of the room and how that relates to the injuries she sustained.
I actually went to Locus eventually, so probably 2015-ish, I can't remember the precise date, and I saw how remarkably limited the space was in which she could have been attacked. Now, of course, if you've got limited space and you're carrying a blunt weapon that could perpetrate some of these injuries, your ability to get additional velocity is actually compromised by the amount of space that you have. So the standard approach to wielding a blunt instrument would be, which is the mass in our equation, would be to lift the implement, the weapon, as far above the head or as far backwards as you could, so that you can really get that velocity, which is the critical part of that energy, velocity squared, so that you can really develop the velocity of it, like a golf club and striking a golf ball, so you can get that. Now, if there isn't sufficient space to do that, then all of a sudden the energy which you can develop to cause the injury is limited, because you can't get the velocity in. And then the mass might become slightly more important in terms of the sort of injury that you're left with. So one might say, well, you know, common sense dictates. So if I come back to this business of how can we tell whether it's a suicidal death or a homicidal death or an accidental death, well, what you look at and what you consider critically is the other evidence, the circumstantial evidence, the evidence of witnesses, the other scientific evidence. What does that do to help determine things like, you know, wounding potential and the position of the body and therefore the sort of tissue that is struck and is therefore distorted by the energy that's transferred? So that would be one. Secondly, the pattern of injuries. So if you've got more than one injury and you have a whole pattern of injuries, then you can start thinking about the position of the body, where the injuries are, and why the injuries would be in that particular location. So the pattern of injuries becomes important. So if somebody, for example, is injuring themselves, then they're going to actually injure a part that they can reach. Yeah. They're going to injure a part that they think will actually produce the effect that they want, death in suicides, of course. And there are ways that we recognise that people will go about these things. Whereas, of course, critically, the defensive injuries which one sees, which might not in themselves be in any way fatal, but make an indication of, first of all, whether the victim is actually able to mount a defence, to be sometimes intuitively defending themselves. What would you do? Well, you put your hands up to avoid blows landing on the parts of the body that you innately know are important, the head and the chest and so on. You put your hands up, you put your arms up, and these then take a series of blows that are directed because you're shielding the part that was aimed for. And if you take Brenda, she had these injuries to her hands and to her wristwatch was smashed and so on, and she had injuries to her fingers. And, well, these really can easily be interpreted as defensive injuries, where she's recognised what's happening, she's recognised an attack which otherwise was predominantly about her head, and she has put her hands up to shield her head. And of course, her hands then are caught up in the injury pattern. Then you see, yes, this pattern of injury equates to a homicide, a suicide, an accident.
He goes into a lot more detail, including a discussion about the weapon used. You might have picked up there a mention of Brenda's watch and the mark on her wrist, which is relevant in my discussion with one of the most important witnesses, retired forensic officer Eric Jensen, who you heard recovered the paint fleck. In his interview, he reveals more than a few details which again weren't heard in court, including the time Brenda's watch had stopped. You'll remember from the evidence that it was found broken under her body.
And actually, I went over this with Professor James Grieve, who was one of the people who re-examined the post-mortem. And on her wrist, there is the exact indentation of what the watch would have been when it would have... I'm imagining that the murder weapon was struck when she was defending herself, and the impression was there, which would be a fair assumption that at the time that it was struck would be the time that it stopped. And that timing does actually fit with, we know that she returned to her home at 2:30 in the morning. And if we are to believe that Kit Harrison is the person responsible, he was at the train station in Stonehaven when the clock struck 5, which meant he would have had to leave, you know, the back of 4. So that would all fit in with that. And I think it is an important thing to know the time of death. I've certainly sat through trials where an alarm clock was knocked over and a battery dislodged, which matched the exact time that neighbours heard screams or, you know, some sort of altercation going on. So I think it would be safe to say that that would be the time that she died.
Well, interesting, Isla, in the room where she was murdered, there was a small table with an overturned coffee mug and 2 alarm clocks. And I suspect that she had a cup of tea before, or a cup of coffee or some hot juice before she went to bed that day, and possibly set 2 alarms, because it's my understanding that she was needed at work for some aspect or other that very day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's why the colleagues went round, because it wasn't like her to not turn up. Now, there was something else that you found relating to her ring. Tell me about what that was.
That was interesting too. At the mortuary, I cannot recall if it was Doc Henry, the pathologist, or myself, at his request, to take off a ring from one of Brenda's fingers. Now, I didn't take an accurate note of which finger the ring came off, but I, thinking about it, I'm pretty sure it would have been the right ring finger, which may have been dislocated or broken even. I think there might have been something in the subsequent pathologist's report indicating that that particular finger was more badly damaged than the other 9. Well, anyway, when the ring was being removed, a small fragment of wood fell out.
And that piece of wood was tested. And you'll need to hear the rest of his interview to hear the findings. I also interviewed Advocate Depute Alec Prentice KC before and after the verdict. And among the many questions I asked him, I was interested to hear his thoughts on the calibre of the Crown witnesses.
Have you been surprised at how incredibly sharp and an amazing recall that the witnesses that you have had, despite their age?
The witnesses in this case, in the main, were colleagues and family members of Brenda Page, most of whom had glittering careers and are highly intelligent people. It was quite remarkable, looking at the testimony of some of them, that their recall was pretty good. Often it's necessary to produce statements to prompt memories, and you would expect that in things like telephone numbers or registration numbers or even dates and times. But the events which the witnesses described in the main were done from recall and in a very articulate and clear manner.
Not to cast judgment on people who are no longer here or worked in the case previously, but if you had been around at the time, do you think you would have pushed for it? Because I think certainly myself and other journalists, we're all sitting there, thinking, if they had all this, then why did they not go forth with it at the time?
It is obvious that the evidence I've led so far, leaving aside the biological evidence of DNA comparisons, that the paint flake, for example, the evidence there was in the same shape as it was in 1978. The other circumstances all bound together seem to me to provide a case to answer. I don't know why proceedings were not marked all these years ago. Speaking for myself, it does seem to me that there was a sufficiency of evidence.
This confirmed to me what I suspected, and you'll hear in another episode the opinion of the detective in charge of the reinvestigation and Kit Harrison's arrest in 2020. And it seems attitudes back in 1978 had great importance in the decision to not prosecute at that time. We'd been waiting for a silver bullet, but there wasn't one. I go on to ask Mr. Prentice what he believed the most compelling pieces of evidence were for the Crown case.
That's a hard one, actually.
A hard one, but he does choose something, and it came from one of the witnesses who was robustly challenged by the defence. One person who was key to the case, but didn't give evidence, was retired Detective Inspector Gary Winter, who was in charge of the reinvestigation and the person who fought hard to get it to court. He revealed to me that my interview with Brenda's sister Rita from the documentary in 2002 was the clincher for persuading the Crown and the Procurator Fiscal's office to move forward with charging Kit Harrison. Mr. Winter was in agreement with Mr. Prentice that this was not your typical murder trial, largely down to the main players and the witnesses.
It was like the Avengers assemble of witnesses. You had lawyers, lecturers, professors, doctors, the most eloquent, educated people who were really keen to give evidence, even given their age and even given how far they had to travel and wanted to tell a story that you don't often get. You know, I had many murder trials with where some of the witnesses have much more chaotic lifestyles and maybe, you know, have dependency issues and that's got them involved in crime and they've then got some convictions that potentially give the defence loads of options to question integrity. Very difficult to question the integrity of people like Nicol Hosey, who's now a sheriff, and you know, and all these other people, and you go, so back to my point about they're all lying and I'm not. Mm-hmm. Well, right. So the sheriff's lying, and he's got no motive to lie and risk his full reputational career on, you know, committing perjury. And this professor, all these people, and you go, oh, come on.
I also asked him what his thoughts were when it emerged Kit Harrison would go into the witness box.
I'm thinking this is going to be box office. Mm-hmm. You know, this is going to be, he will not be able to contain himself. I actually wondered whether we would get a violent explosion in court, albeit he's an old man now, but that's maybe more down to Alec Prentice not being the kind of antagonist. Mm. I think, for a number of reasons, he probably wouldn't have wanted to antagonise him to the point where probably for health reasons more than anything else, but, you know, he a bit like us when we interviewed him, you just want him to speak because mm-hmm. he will walk into his own traps.
One of the most fascinating interviews, and again it's split into two parts due to its length, is with Defence KC Brian McConaughey.
How does he compare to other people you've represented in terms of where he scales in the sort of intelligence eccentric level? Was he one that really stands out?
Yeah. I would have thought, no disrespect to MD that I'm missing out, but I would have think he was probably the most intelligent person I've represented, and eccentric, yes. I think he would certainly be top of that list as well.
Later in the interview, I asked him about the decision for his client to go into the witness box, an option many accused do not take up.
Did you want him to give evidence?
I mean, there are cases where you have a view about it. It was certain it was going to happen. Yeah, so there was no point in me having a view about whether it was good, bad or indifferent. I suspect he probably had to anyway.
The fact he'd also done the interview in 2020, you would want further explanations, probably.
Yeah, I just think in a case of this nature where what has happened is so personal in the sense of it was his ex-wife and the evidence stacking up about which I knew he had a view and had an explanation for, that it was just inevitable that he was going to give evidence. So I never, you know, sometimes you do think, usually what I will say to a client is perhaps the question you've got to ask yourself is, can I make this any better? But I suspect I did have some sort of conversation. I don't remember it. I suspect I'd have some sort of conversation with him about giving evidence, but it was never in doubt.
And you can't really coach them. You can tell them what they might expect and things like that, or a bit of advice to just answer the question, etc. But beyond that,
yeah. Well, you can't. You know, it's not like the American series where they have the witness in and cross-examine them for 6 hours or whatever. It just doesn't happen. Generally, your advice is to keep your answers short. But I don't even think I really had that discussion with him.
How did you feel at the end of his evidence?
And on that cliffhanger, I will stop. That is just a tiny part of my interview with him. He's extremely open and frank, as are all the interviewees, and there's one coming up that you'll want to listen to. I'll announce their identity soon. It's 2 hours long and reveals so much to a part of the story that has never been heard before. So if you want to hear the rest of these interviews and many more, you can by joining the Patreon, which has so much added value to your understanding of this case and is also helping support me and my work. You've listened to this entire series for free. I do not get paid by the platforms. It's more than a year of my life I've worked on it without being funded. So for the price of a cup of coffee, you'll enjoy more than 40 extra episodes plus so much more. I've tried to create a Murder HQ online and answer all the questions you might have. And I'm hoping to have a live Q&A after the trial with someone very important. All you need to do is click on the link in the show notes and sign up. You can cancel at any time, but you'll have access to the entire catalogue upon joining. Your support would be greatly appreciated and will determine whether I can make another series. So thank you for listening and thank you for your continued support. And brace yourself for the next episode.